Hello, 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 and welcome to a very special episode of If I Speak. It's mid-August, or it will be by the time you're listening to this, and Christmas has come early. But before I tell you why, I'm joined by my co-host and the very bestest of red-nosed reindeer, Moya Lothian-McLean. How's it going?
It just feels so blasphemous to talk about Christmas. I know where your metaphor's going and where you're driving us to, but I'm lodging an objection. at invoking Christmas in August.
Well, like, some parts of the world have hot Christmases, right? Like the whole of the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, but not Britain yet. Maybe in a couple of years when we finish really heating up the planet. But right now, just also Christmas in August, it's not even that hot. It's like 20 degrees and overcast. Oh, God, I can't talk about summer. If I talk about summer too much, I'll cry. Oh. We used to be a country.
All right, well, no need to cry.
Look what they took from
no
us.
No need to cry. Because it's not all about your problems, Moya. Today is all about other people's problems. That's right. What is in my sleigh, my festive sack, is a whole bunch of audience dilemmas. We're doing an I'm in big trouble bonanza. We had a little bit of a backlog with the dilemmas. We didn't want people to feel neglected. So that's all we're doing today. We think they're fun. If you've got a problem that we couldn't possibly make any worse, email us at ifispeak@novaramedia.com. That's ifispeak@novaramedia.com. But first and foremost, rumour has it, Moya has some questions for me.
Thought I'd theme the first one. Yeah, I thought I'd keep it in with the whole theme of the show. So, number one, what is the worst advice you've ever received?
Oh my God. What's the worst advice I've ever received? I was once talking to a friend about feeling very angry about my absentee father, and he was like, we could just go burn down his house. And I was like, ha ha ha, very funny. And he was like, no, but seriously though. So I guess that wasn't that great as advice goes. I didn't take it.
Wow, that is really bad advice.
Actually, every time I'm upset at someone, he's like, burn down their house. Like, every single person who's ever upset me, he's like, burn down their house.
Not to overanalyze. Does this person give good advice normally, or is that just the summation of his advice?
No, he can. He's a very empathetic person and will, like, hear you out and talk through the feelings. But when it's like, well, what should we do? He's like, arson.
There's a block there between being able to hear and then being able to advise on the next steps. So maybe he's a receptacle for talking through things with, but less of someone who can actually deal with a sort of solution for it.
Maybe so. So yeah, he's the sort of most reliable bad advice giver I know.
Yeah, that's because his advice is the same. He doesn't actually know how to give solutions-based advice, which is unlike many men. So you know what? You've bucked the gender trend there. Question two, fight or flight?
Neither, freeze.
Yeah, I would do this too. They say it's fight or flight, but no. Sometimes it's freeze a lot of the time. Freeze and not exactly panic, but freeze and shut down like a hedgehog.
Fight, flight, freeze, and befriend. But the freeze is like an evolved strategy that mammals have because it's a way to like play dead. So whatever's threatening you loses interest. And also, animals may have evolved it to give themselves less painful deaths.
That's really interesting.
So when they feel like, you know, the teeth of the saber-toothed tiger in their neck, they freeze up and you don't feel things.
And befriend is a strategy that's evolved from girls' schools in the 1950s.
Just make friends and it would be fine.
It's like the woman, the girl putting my head down the toilet and telling me I'm trash, being like, befriend her. And then suddenly you're ruling the school. That's a real modern adaptation. Okay, number three. I was thinking about the fact we don't give people flowers while they're still around to smell them. So who is a peer that you really admire and you haven't told them?
Oh, you know what? I like to think that I tell people when I admire them. Who do I admire right now? I mean, I did actually also tell her this, but our colleague Rivka Brown has been fucking smashing it at the moment, and I'm just always so excited to read her pieces. So yeah, she deserves some flowers. I think you deserve some flowers. You are just like a fucking like ideas like generator workhorse. I always think that like my I've been talking about you to people, and I'm like, the thing about Moya that you've got to understand is that she's a bullet. You've got to like build the gun around her and just bam, she'll go. But like if you don't build the gun, like it'll explode. But like build the gun and just like deadly.
You do tell
maybe
me though,
like
you,
a less violent metaphor.
You tell me nice things all the time, so I love that you told me that, and it wasn't meant to be an exercise in fishing for compliments, but you tell me a lot. I think maybe you just tell people, so there's maybe not someone you haven't told that you admire them. But Rivka is killing the game right now,
smashing it
on a roll,
smashing it. Who do you want to give some flowers to? Someone that you haven't given flowers to.
Who do I want to give flowers to that I don't tell? I mean, I've said this on podcast before, and also I don't think he's a peer, but I think Aditya Chakraborty is one of the finest journalists and minds working in modern media. But I don't think I've directly told him that. I think he's amazing and prescient. But maybe you're prescient if you just take time and do work that looks at the clues. So he wrote a piece last year about how asylum hotels, the patterns that he was seeing in the sort of monstering of them would explode all over the country if we didn't watch out. And quelle surprise! And he's done all this. He just knows to look in the gaps, and he's also an economist, which helps you add up patterns. And I just think he's such an empathetic journalist. It's like that's the gold standard for me. So, but I don't think I've said that to him. So I'll just say it here again, not to him. keep on the pattern.
No, he's a phenomenal journalist, a phenomenal journalist. Yeah. I'm a very big fan. But it's time for us to advise others.
Ooh. I'm stretching.
I'm in big trouble bonanza. Like, honestly, limber up, twist the spine, take some deep breaths. We're going in.
Dear Moya and Ash, I'm a mid-20s bi cisgender woman. I recently ended a long-term relationship with a cis man 7 years older than me. We broke up about a year ago. It continued on and off for a while, but long story short, this spring, I recently decided I'm very happy to be just single. I then recently met this guy, who's in his early 40s, nearly 20 years older than me, through work when he was in a more senior position. We no longer work together, but are in the same field of work / community of people. We've been seeing each other casually, which has been really nice, and a low pressure post-relationship. I don't think either of us have seen anything serious with each other long term, but I do enjoy his company, find him intelligent, and he treats me with respect. That being said, I can't help but notice all the significant factors and differences between our careers and friends around us that highlight the age gap and become especially heightened when around each of our respective friend groups. His friends are actually some of my colleagues, tutors, mentors, which can be a bit awkward. Somehow I've always ended up dating older people, except for my only former female partner, where we were the same age. I don't really know why this is. Part of it's probably due to familial, gendered, and circumstantial responsibility that I feel I took on at a young age for various reasons. The other part of it may be I'm just one of the youngest of my friend group, but I never thought much about it when dating someone who may be a bit older than me in the past, because I felt like they were in a similar stage of life, career, and often friendships that felt more equal. I can't think why this person would want to be with me if he sees these differences too. And is this actually an unequal power dynamic, or am I just overanalyzing it? There's also an extra sort of bit of information they give next. Simultaneously, this may not be related, but I'm finding as I've been growing in my career, I've been encountering a lot of straight men who definitely take advantage of the fact I'm a younger female figure in the room, acting inappropriately by associating my physical appearance to my identity, which has led me to question my abilities and can be quite exhausting as someone who's experienced a history of sexual trauma. He, of course, is not that person and doesn't make me feel that way by any means, but it can be hard to dislocate all these experiences happening at once. Lots of love. Sorry for the rant, and thank you for making my Tuesday morning something to look forward to. The question they've posed as the dilemma is why this person would want to be with me if he sees these differences too, and is this an unequal power dynamic, or am I just overanalyzing it? Do you want to go first, or should I?
Oh, I mean, I've been thinking about this one a bit because I think this is our first age gap discourse on the podcast.
Wait, we should have some sort of like,
for so long.
Child, when you're
like,
this,
we need some like confetti cannons.
We need a confetti cannon noise and some sort of dun 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 dun.
age gap discourse.
Age gap, let's go.
I mean, for me, there are the specifics of this situation and then there are more generalizable things, right? Let's maybe start with the specifics of the situation, because I always think how someone writes in is so, so revealing. So it's like, well, I don't see anything wrong about this, but like maybe there's something wrong with it. And actually being around older people, I do feel objectified in these ways and it's sort of triggering for me and there's something wrong with that. But of course, like he's not that guy and it's different. Like, you know, I feel that there is something that sits uncomfortably within you about this relationship and there's something there for you to explore about why is it older men in particular? Because I know that you're suggesting that it could be, you know, due to like familial responsibility that you took on, but why is it men? Why is it older men? Like, I, you know, you've raised the idea of sexual trauma there. Is it, you know, do you find yourself being drawn both to someone who could look like the perpetrator, but also at the same time could offer protection? Like, is there something there about like a compulsion to repeat? Is there something about wanting to escape a sense of your own youth and vulnerability by surrounding yourself with older people? Because I kind of feel that if it was the case that you were like, hey, like I'm seeing this much older guy, other people don't seem to get it, but it feels really good for me. How could I explain it to them? That would be one thing. That would be indicating to me that like you do just feel fine about it and it's much more about how others around you are perceiving it. But the way in which you've written this, there's so much rumination and so much discomfort and so much of a sense of like how people are looking at you being young, not how people are looking at your relationship as, you know, having this significant age gap, that tells me that there is some element of discomfort within yourself. As for the generalizable thing, I understand being drawn to older people, particularly when you're in your early 20s and late teens, because particularly as women, it's like, you look around you and you see guys your own age, like, you know, if you're dating guys and you don't feel understood by them, you don't feel like they've got the things that you want. You've got an idea of like what romance is and like what connection is, which is, you know, not within the emotional range of people your own age very often. And so you look to older guys. I think that's really, really understandable. For me, the bit where I'm like, uh-oh, SpaghettiOs, is when you're looking at it from the perspective of the older person. Because, you know, you're talking here about an age gap of 20 years. Like, obviously, an age gap of 20 years for me would be like a 12-year-old. But like, even if it was 10 years or 12 years, right? I'm 32, like they're 20. We don't share a social world. Do you know what I mean? Like we don't. Like our life places are really, really different. And in particular, if like all my friends are the same age as me and all my friends are like in a similar life place, like this 20-year-old cannot be my equal in the relationship. They cannot have the same agency in the relationship or the same ability to define what it is according to what their needs are, you know? And especially if they're entering my world of like, you know, friends who are all in their like, you know, late 20s to late 30s, it's like they're always going to be at that bit of a disadvantage. And so for me, it's like my priority and what I want is a relationship of equals, right? And so that means not dating someone significantly younger than me. You know, my husband is 1 month younger than me. So I guess that makes me the cougar in that relationship, a whole month and 4 days. But yeah, for me, it's very much about how can you be on a par with each other in defining what the relationship is. And I just don't see how that's possible in this circumstance. I think that there are some cases where a couple make that happen. You know, so I'm not writing all of it off. I think that, you know, there'll be really specific circumstances, personality traits, situations where they can make that happen. I don't feel like that's the case in this one. But yeah, Moya, what do you think? Where do you stand on the old age gap?
Very difficult for me because I recently have reversed my positions on not dating younger men. I used to be very sort of like, what's the point? You know, like if they're this bad at my age, imagine what younger men are going to be like. And I think there's a gendered thing to this. And then, you know what? I met a younger man and he was 10 times nicer and interesting and actually quite open and curious to the world in a way that my age mates were not. However, I did say that there would be no future because he was younger than me to such a degree. I was like, you need to go and live your life first. But I had a very enjoyable time with him and it sort of made me think, well, maybe I would date, you know, 3, even 4 pushing it years younger, depending on the person. Like consider like a more serious relationship with them. 20 years, however, is a lot. It's a lot. It's a lot. And there's a big difference between, you know, the person that I don't want to get into too many details here, but it was more than like 4 years. And I think that for me was a cutoff. Maybe if I was much older and he was much older, then it would again be different because of a different stage of life. But this person says what? They say that they're in, yeah, they're in their mid-20s and they're dating someone who must be in their mid-40s. That's very, very different, like you've said. What I'm also interested in here is what you kind of touched on a bit is like the narratives we attach to age. And it sounds like this letter writer is maybe doing a similar thing to me, which is we're trying to assess who will hurt us the least. And whether that's because there's an obstacle in the way of the relationship, which means, you know, this letter writer is saying it's not going to be serious. We don't think it's going to be serious. Why are you writing us a dilemma then about how your lives interact and whether there's any way of like any compatibility? That's a contradictory message there. So either this is beyond this man and you just in general want to interrogate these patterns, or you are assessing without realizing for the potential of there being something more long-lasting, more serious, and you're discomforted by your findings, which is you've unconsciously concluded there's actually no chance because our lives don't align in the right way. But you don't want to admit that, you don't want to make sense of that. So you're asking us whether this is just about unequal power dynamics. I don't even think it's about unequal power dynamics. I think that you are just not compatible in the way that you want because of where you are in life. There's power dynamics in there, but I think it comes down to the fact you're not equal in those senses. But we think who will hurt us the least. And when I was thinking of this younger guy, I was like, he was so nice to me and I felt like he wouldn't hurt me in the way that my age mates would because they're so jaded. I always make this joke about men my age, which is and older, which is they've seen too much. They haven't learned from it, but they've seen it. And it's made them so bitter and jaded. Whereas the young ones, they're kind of the same in lots of ways, but they're just like, they have a bit more hope.
I've got a question for you. If one of your male friends was dating someone significantly younger, by which I'm talking about age gaps of 10 years or more, right? How would you feel about it?
I'd side-eye it. But I would bitch about in private, be like, what's going on there? And then in public with that male friend, I'd probably be like, well, we'll accept it. Because unless someone comes to me and says there's a specific problem here, or like, you know, unless the girlfriend would come to me and ask for some sort of advice and I would sense that something was wrong, I wouldn't think it's my business to get directly involved. But I would just be like, that just shows his immaturity. The thing is, like, when I was 17, how graphic do I get?
Do it.
I lost my virginity to someone 10 years older. And I look back and I'm like, you disgusting rat. Like, not about me, but about the guy. Like, what the fuck were you doing? I remember being...
Exactly.
I also remember something disgusting this man said, which was like, I'm a virgin, by the way. And he was... No, I said, I need to tell you something. And he was like, what? And he said, you're not 15, are you? I was like, no, I'm a virgin. He would have done it anyway. He wouldn't have given a fuck.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have given a fuck.
I remember being in those situations too, like as a teenager. I remember like how much, you know, youth was fetishized. And I'm not saying that you know, that dynamic, you know, between the ages of like 15 and 17, that's then the same as like, you know, when you're like 21 and he's like, you know, whatever. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not like, bah, like it's all paedophilia one way or another. Like, I'm not saying that. But it's just like, that man's had a whole adult life before you were born. Do you know what I mean? Like, before you were born.
Yeah. I'm still really torn on this because, again, mid-20s and 40s, inherently, I'm not like there's anything really wrong with it. It depends how... The thing is, she's discomforted by this, but she's not like he's... She's like, why does he want to be with me? You're creeped out by the fact he wants to be with you, even though you want to be with him, but you're still disgusted by his attraction to you on some level. And that's what's interesting to me. Like, you don't, you find it weird. You find him weird. You find the whole situation weird. And I just think a relationship based on that inherently has somewhere where you find your partner weird for being attracted to you is not going to work, whether casual or not. But I also, you know, that we talk about harms and all of this, and it's like, I think it is fucking weird when it's like, what do you have in common? But sometimes you do get these connections across generations where you have things in common. And it might be a connection where the power dynamic isn't that inherent, but you do say his friends are like your mentors and teachers. That is a new element as well. It's just, again, I think until there is some sort of like mass feminist emotional revolution, men of all ages are going to repeat similar patterns, well, straight men particularly, but they tend to repeat similar patterns because they don't have this fucking language of what they actually want in life, what makes them satisfied. They don't have this, and I'm not, again, it's not all men, but I'm just saying broadly, will to change stuff, you know, bell hooks. There's not this expression and understanding of why they might do things or why they might be attracted to younger women or why they might want someone who they see as more pliable or more innocent, etc., in their lives. So I don't know. It's just like I see men of all ages doing the same shit and women of all ages do the same shit as well. But with men, because we live in a patriarchal society, there is a different resonance to when they do the same shit or when they repeat these patterns. But I've noticed more women who are like, I'm going to date 10 years younger. I've got friends who are like, I'm only dating men who are like 8 years younger than me now. Why is that? Why are we so disappointed with our own age mates? I think that's something to examine. However, what I would say about to this person is, you said it's not serious. You need to be honest with yourself whether you think that or not. And you also need to be honest with yourself whether you're creeped out by this man, because I think you are. Even if he doesn't deserve it, I think you're still creeped out.
That's very good advice. Shall we move on to the next letter?
Yes. Regale us.
Dear Ash and Moya, I recently had a very heated argument with my father over the current genocide taking place in Gaza. He argued that what is happening is not a genocide and that Israel is effectively the good guy in the war. It was basically like hearing the most obvious pro-Israel talking points that are often on the news. We ended up shouting at each other and it became personal. I ended up leaving and haven't spoken to him since. Part of me wonders if his stance is informed by some insecurity about his relative lack of education. He never went to university, I did, etc. And is simply looking for a topic that will make me angry and where he can feel intellectually superior. The alternative is that he actually believes some of the racist atrocity-denying nonsense that he was coming out with. He wants to repair the relationship after the argument, but my impulse is to tell him that if he doesn't recognise what is happening as a genocide, then we have nothing to say to each other. This all falls in line with an unforgiving attitude I seem to be taking in my personal life at the moment, which is perhaps informed by some mistreatment or perceived mistreatment at the hands of others. I don't want to forgive people who support what is happening. I don't want to talk to them. I consider them to be not very nice people. I'm so angry that sometimes I feel like I could die. I don't know what to do with all of this anger. Politics in the UK makes me angry. Labour makes me angry. The Tories make me angry. Starving kids make me angry. And it's all about me, you know? That anger is like some selfish reflex to make it all about myself. Even this email is full of self-pity, but I don't know what use I am to anyone when I can't even talk to my own father. What do I do? Do I forgive him? Do I move on? How do I stop feeling so angry at everyone? It really hurts.
Forgive yourself first. Forgive yourself first is what I say. You're furious that you feel so angry. You feel like it's a failing on your part to feel this angry, and that you're not of use. That's a really telling phrase, this idea that you're not of use. What use am I of to anyone? That's like a huge It's a huge self-loathing thing to think about yourself, that you failed because you're so passionate about something that it makes you upset, and that when you talk to someone you love and they disagree on something that you have a very strong principles about, that makes you so upset you don't want to talk to them about it anymore, and you don't want to talk to them full stop. I think that is a perfectly understandable emotional response. And this idea that you have to be of use, that you have to be the disciple going out and spreading the message, we can get onto that, but you need to be nicer to yourself about the way you're feeling. You need to be nicer to yourself, because we're left on our own to deal with a lot of these emotions and frustrations and the anger that is very natural when you see the state of the world. And if you occupy a left-wing position, will be your natural response. So you have to be nice to yourself first before you can be nice to anyone else, I think, is an initial starting point.
Yeah, you sound very isolated, actually. Like, you sound like there is this anger and it's driving you away from people. There's a generalized unforgiving attitude. I think Moya is completely right. You have to forgive yourself. But I also think you need to put yourself in community with other people. And you can do that politically around Palestine. You know, there are organizations actively working on this at the moment, whether it's as part of the, you know, boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, or, you know, pressuring their own workplaces, or, you know, coordinating other kinds of community responses. I think that could be a really good thing for you, because also one of the things that happens when you participate in political organizing like that, you realize that you have to be able to forgive and accept some of the mess of other people in order for those organizations to function. So you all broadly agree, but if you go in there with a very skeptical attitude towards forgiveness and constantly wanting to protect yourself against others, the whole thing falls apart. So I think that can be like a useful space to begin. I think that there are the things that you're saying about your relationship with your dad. And, you know, parents and children, it's complicated. And there are all these ways in which parents want to feel that they're still your parent, they've still got the power, and they can still teach you a thing or two about the world. And they feel angry when they think they can, you know, no longer do that sometimes. And similarly, you know, you feel the sense of like, but if I'm to love you, that means I have to bring you in line with the things which I feel to be most morally imperative. And of course, recognizing the genocide as a genocide is morally imperative. I'm not saying let that go and forgive your father, but perhaps view it as more than one conversation. Like, people never shift after one conversation or one argument. It takes time. Takes patience, takes multiple conversations, takes them thinking about things on their own, reflecting on things that you've said. Sometimes it involves you listening as they talk through a thought process, which might end up in a very different place from where they started. But that will involve you dropping some barriers. And I think maybe being a bit less scared of people hurting you, because that seems to be so prominent in this email.
I'd also say, this is not an excuse, but the generation that I imagine your father is, which is just one or two above us, there is, you know, there's different messaging this around what Israel is. I imagine he'll be exposed. He has been exposed to a lot of, oh, it's both sides. Oh, you know, it's just all that trouble over there. Blah, blah, blah. The way that people talk about it, for a long time in the mainstream media, etc. Sometimes what I like, I have a similar issue in that I have a beloved father figure who loves to argue with me. I don't want to argue. He loves to bring up politics and wants to yell at me about it. You know, like, there's something in there about how he expresses repressed emotions, and it's through disagreeing with me on politics and trying to tell me what's what and all of that. And I just say, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about this. And recently he was saying to me, oh, you know, I voted for someone and you won't like it. And I was like, who? I was also like, I honestly didn't really care. I was like, it doesn't matter. Like, the vote's done now. And I just want to know who. And I was like, was it Reform? And he was like, no. And I said, was it the Tories? And he was like, no. And I said, was it Labour? I, like, really confused, because I'm like, why would I be that bothered? He said, no. And I said, the Greens? And he went, yes. And I was like, why would I care if you vote for the Greens? And he was like, because you're a Labour person. And I realised, just like, in his head, it's so mixed up, my political beliefs. And he has this caricature idea of like where I sit and like what particular tribe I'm in and how fixed it is. And people, we have these confused understandings of each other's political positions. And they're based off like a few fights or arguments, and especially with parental relationships, where you actually probably have a lot more common ground than you think. But sometimes when you're in an angry situation, the best thing to do is just like de-escalate it. Look, I tell you, I don't want to talk about this like this. And then think about other ways, like Ash said, you might be able to get through. I had a situation with a relative who for a while seemed to be heading in a direction that was getting a bit transphobic. It was worrying me. They were reading the Times. They were, you know, starting to say stuff about women's spaces, all of this kind of thing. And I was like, they said they didn't understand, you know, they them pronouns. I was like, oh no. And my response at first was to sort of like yell at them, and that didn't work. That was no use. And then I sent them a couple of books, and I just said, you know, this is worrying, a bit worrying to me. And I tried to reach them a bit more on a level, but I'd also backed away the conversation. I just sent them books. I said, oh, this is really good. And I talked about, no, it sounds cheesy, but I was talking about my friends who are like, I'm trans, you're not being like, my friend is amazing, just being like, talking about my friends, being like, oh, they've just done this cool thing, or like, I went for lunch with them, and showing them that I'm in like total community with people, and these people are human beings, not just being like, this person has done this amazing thing and they deserve to be singled out as an exceptional person. Just literally showing them my life and how I exist alongside people who happen to be a member of the community that they were being a bit skeptical of. And then they also, you know, started getting more involved with like actual feminist organizing, where it was intersectional. And all these things came together, and they don't have a Time subscription anymore, and they don't say transphobic shit anymore. And they're very like, women's spaces need to be inclusive, like we need to protect all women, that kind of stuff, like on board. And what it took was a little pushing at it from all sides, and just like keeping them in community with me and treating them with sort of like love and respect rather than preaching at them. People hate being preached at. It's the knee-jerk reaction, but people hate it. Absolutely. So what I would say is like, I would maybe send your dad just a letter being like, oh, it really upsets me when we have these discussions, but I understand, and like, we can talk about this, but this is my view, and I understand your one, but I'd love it if maybe you like read this book and then send it with a book. I would suggest Doppelganger by Naomi Klein, because it's not a preachy book. It's an amazing book, and it goes into stuff like Israel and Palestine, but knits it all with other things that might be tied to it, and really does it in a way where I feel like if you're reading that, there's a good chance of it just like shaking up your views a bit, even if you are someone who's part of like the diagonalist coalitions that she talks about, because of the way that she writes. But that's the kind of thing, you know, if you're in the car with him, you've got a podcast on. Oh, that podcast happens to be, I don't know, Navarra Media Downstream, something like that. You know, it's osmosis and little bits and little sending stuff, but not preaching. And I'm sorry, because it's annoying, and it's lots of people will hear this and be like, no, we need to like cut these people off and do this. And you know what? I understand that view. It's just not one I subscribe to, and you are entitled to it, and you can practice it. It's just not the advice I'm giving. And this is my and Ash's podcast, so this is what you'll hear here.
I actually think that, like, you know, it's one thing to withdraw from people because you go like, I'm not able to do this. I'm not able to do this. Like, this person, it's too stressful for me. I can't do it. I think that is perfectly legitimate. And also at various times in your life, you're always going to have to do that at some point, right? That's part of the human experience. But don't make a virtue out of it, right? It is not a virtuous political position to throw people away, because then how do you think that they're going to be persuaded ever? That requires contact with other people. And so if what you want to do is keep making your pool of persuadable smaller, great, fine, do that. That's not how movements win. Should we move on?
Yep. Ready for this one?
Oh my God. Yeah, you've got to read it out. This is my favorite one.
I'm going to read it out. I'm not going to say anything about, I'm not going to add any descriptor before this, but this is a big dilemma.
I love it.
Hello,
I
both. Love it. I'm a huge fan of the show, and as a young woman trying to make my way in the world, you both really inspire me. I think it was from one of you that I originally heard on social media about the novel Evenings and Weekends by Oisin McKenna. Earlier this year, I devoured the book, and as much as it's cliche to say, it really made me fall in love again with literature and with life in general. Oh, I loved it so much. I've done something I never did before and went to an event to hear the author speak, and he signed my copy of the book. I'm not generally a materialist person, but it really meant a lot to me and is one of my most treasured possessions. A month later, I met a lovely man from Hinge. This is a bit long, but I'll tell you all this for context. I've grown quite jaded with dating apps, but with him, it was different straight away. We had an instant connection. He seemed really interested and engaged. However, after the first date, I told him I prefer to be friends because I wasn't sure if I was attracted to him. But have to hang out with him a couple times in friendly, low-pressure environments, I realised I am attracted to him and was probably holding something back because of my own long-standing fear of intimacy, terror of my own sexuality, deep repulsion towards men. Can we just normalise, you know, having to hang around someone for a bit to see if you actually fancy them? That's
it's
normal.
It's not a pathology.
It's normal.
It's not a pathology.
That's meeting someone on a first date and kissing them. I can tell you, as someone who dates sober, is fucking weird and only happens very occasionally. The reason we think it's normal to just be able to like fuck someone or have like kiss them on a first date, which is fine. I'm just saying it's because of booze most of the time. You're lubricated up and your inhibitions are down. Great. Fucking someone's fine on a first date, but it is totally normal to hang out with someone several times and then see if you actually fancy them. It's not about even attraction growing. It's just, I remember when I met, I will get back to this dilemma, but I remember when I met my ex, and on the first date, I was so interested in him and so like, this person is so beautiful. I love everything about their voice, their everything. Like, they're so funny. We're having a great time. And I still thought, I don't know if I fancy him. Because, and obviously I was so engaged and so interested, and there was the attraction brewing, but I still didn't know. And it's like, then on the second date and the third dates, I was like, wow, no, you fancy this person so much. But it took a while, and we took a while to build up physical intimacy. And you know what? It made it even better. I'm not saying don't fuck on the first date, but sometimes when you build an emotional connection, it can just be a little bit better when you actually do, because you feel comfortable and safe with them. I'm just saying.
I completely agree, but get on with this dilemma because it's so fucking good. It's so good.
Sorry, dilemma. Right. Because of my own fear of intimacy, repulsion towards men, blah, blah, blah. So, respectfully told him how I felt. We went on a couple more dates and I kind of fell for him. On the last date we went on, I lent him my signed copy of Evenings and Weekends, as he mentioned he wanted to read it, and I thought it would be a sweet gesture. However, as most men do, he spontaneously lost interest, and instead of being direct about his feelings, he pied me off for a bit until I confronted him over text. He said he'd rather be friends. I said I'd rather not be friends, but respectfully asked if he could post my book back. I said this for two reasons. A, he'd kind of acted like a bit of a dick. B, I thought it would be too emotionally messy for me to be friends with someone I have feelings for. However, he didn't return my book. I was so angry, I channeled my rage into music and wrote a song titled Bisexual Men Are Still Men. It may be the best thing I've ever written. I think a title change maybe, but like... I realised that after that, if I want to produce good work, I need to have a little emotional jeopardy in my life, and therefore be beneficial for my art to keep this man in my life, if not my mental health. Girl! I'm going to carry on. I messaged him again recently to ask my book back, and he responded that he'd had a manic episode, not the only one, and apologised profusely for my feelings, hurting my feelings, offering to drop the book off in person the next day. I told him that was okay, I'd be out, but he could drop it through my letterbox. Weeks passed, and I've heard nothing from him. At first, I thought this man was just a bit of a mess. But on deeper analysis, some close friends suggested he may be engaged in some kind of power play with me. Perhaps he felt rejected by me and is using the book as some way to slight me. This may seem extreme, but I came up with this scheme to fake my own death so I could get the book back. Just going to repeat that. I came up with this scheme to fake my own death so I could get the book back. He follows my best friend on Instagram, so she was going to post on her private story that I died, and he'd probably message to ask what happened. She'd then ask him to bring the book back because it's a treasured family item. He would then probably turn up to deliver it back, and I'd jump out and be like, you got pranked. Just making a note. At this point, we'd be able to resume our friendship on a more equal footing with the understanding that we'd both done slightly fucked up things to each other. However, my friend was reluctant to participate in this scheme as she was worried it was unethical. I understand it may be a bit traumatic for him, but he doesn't know me that well, and it's not like he'd believe I was dead forever. I just think it would be funny and hopefully lay the foundation for artistically productive and sexually tense friendship. I would love to hear your thoughts, as I massively respect your opinions. So if either you gave the okay, I'd probably go ahead and proceed with the prank. Is this a prank? Are we being pranked? That's what I want to know. Is faking your own death ethical in this kind of circumstance? If not, how do I get my book back? I really don't want to lose it. It has my name signed in it, and it's very special to me. Seems very perverse for someone to want to keep it. How do I win this power struggle with this man so I finally write my debut album and leave my boring corporate job? Thank you for making it this far. Ash, where do we even start?
Okay, first and foremost, thank you very much for this dilemma, because I've been thinking about it ever since it got emailed to us, and it's one of the funniest things I've ever read in my life. So thank you for that. That's important to say. Second thing to say, and I say this with a great deal of affection and love, this is absolutely not an insult. It is a statement of fact offered with love. You and everyone you know is completely bonkers. You are mad as a wasp sandwich, my friend. Completely off your rocker. I'm kind of into it. Like there's a level of like overthinking and confected drama, which I sort of respect. I think it probably makes, you know, life and the social world more exciting for other people, because they get to talk about your crazy whims and your schemes. But like, I just need you to know, babe, like you're completely, completely nuts. One, is he engaged in a power play? I mean, probably not. He probably just said he'd bring it back and then forgot about it. Like, you know, he seems a bit scatty, right? Just seems like he's a scatty person. Why are your friends being like, you know, maybe he feels a bit rejected by you? I mean, just like other people have lives. Other people have lives. But you know what? Like, you and your friends are really like committed to this kind of like protagonist syndrome. And that's funny. And clearly it's doing something for you all. And it's like a kind of social glue. So, you know, I'm not judging that. The thing about writing a song called Bisexual Men Are Still Men. I mean, this happened to my housemate, which is like a girl who he'd like been hooking up with, wrote a song about him and like performed it in front of him. And I remember being like, that's my idea of a nightmare. He was into it. He thought it was a great song. But I was just like, people on the left, women on the left need to stop writing so many songs about men, right? Like this wet leg business has gone too far. Like just ixnay. But yeah, like dilemma writer, you are a classic overthinker. I wouldn't even say a classic overthinker. I think you're like the, you know, the juggernaut of overthinkers. I think you love exciting narratives and you found an opportunity to weave another one. It just seems that you love a dramatic story and you're trying to turn your life into a big dramatic story. And maybe one of the disappointing things for you might be you realize that people aren't thinking about you as much as you want them to. Because like, what if you fake your own death and he doesn't message your friend? What if he's just like, oh, that's sad. She died. That's kind of crazy. Doesn't DM her. And so you've got no opportunity to like jump out and be like, you got pranked, because then it's not a prank. If there's no reveal, that's just someone thinking you're dead, like forever. But also I kind of want to see where it goes. But you should probably check if faking your own death is illegal. Like, is that a form of fraud?
It is if you get life insurance, but I don't think it is if otherwise. You need to talk to John Darwin, the canoe guy. I've got lots of thoughts.
Go for it.
Letter writer, you're bored. You're bored with your life. You're bored with your corporate life. And you think that you don't really trust in your talent to write unless you have some sort of stimulus. And you say that you're jaded with men. You're both jaded and still have so much hope that when someone rejects you, it cuts you right to the core. And the reason this hurt you so much is because you were starting to invest in it in a way where you were trying to show him your soft belly. by giving him a book that was very special to you, you were, it's not just a book, is it? I've got a friend who's just done this. It's not just a fucking book. When you're giving them a book, it's not only, here's a bit of me, read it to understand me and understand why I like this. And if you're reading this, it's an investment. It's also sort of a promise of a tangible, we're going to meet up at some point. I'm going to get that book back. You never got that. Not only did he pie you off, he pied you off and kept your book. It's a rejection that just feels so humiliating and embarrassing, even though it's not. I want to stress it's not. This is a very normal thing to happen because people are careless with everyone else's emotions. And then you get guilty when you haven't actually, you know that you've let someone down a bit and you have material proof of letting them down, which is why he's put off giving this book back for so long, because he doesn't want to look directly at it, really. So it's better just to ignore it. But the more he does that, the more furious you are, because it's a complete rejection of you, and it's a dismissal. It's a dismissal of you as a person. It's a dismissal of you being an interesting person. And that is an insecurity of yours. That's why you're making up this revenge fantasy. This is what it is. It's a revenge fantasy to prove that you are of interest and to prove that you do interesting things as well. To prove that he still has an investment in you somehow, but also to yourself that you have an exciting life and there's all these exciting things going on. And you know what? You have an exciting life even if you do just work a corporate fucking job and like you don't do this revenge fantasy and someone did pie you off after several dates. All of these things say nothing about you. Nothing about you personally. You have a rich interior life, clearly, and you need to believe in that a bit more and yourself. And the title Bisexual Men Is Still Men is a shit title. I'm really sorry. So change that. But the song is probably quite good. But you don't need him to write the song. You don't need him. You did it because you might have had like something you felt passionate about. But what you need to do is rechannel where you find your passions and where you find, I don't know, the things that you think are worthy of stimulus. Because I'll tell you now, men are really boring. They're so boring, and dating is quite boring. And I feel like maybe you were looking at that as a site of interest, and for a brief moment then someone came along and provided that, but you're never going to find that like sustained interesting stuff in other people in a romantic context if you're dating as a heterosexual woman. Not right now. I'm really sorry, it's not happening. Those are my main points. You felt so rejected and so bad. You've come up with an entire fantasy to prove that to this person that you're still important and that you still matter. And nothing is going to satisfy that. He could come and cry at your funeral and you could watch him and it still won't be satisfying because he still doesn't want to date you. And that again says nothing about you. Nothing about you. It doesn't mean that you're not interested. It doesn't mean that you're not vibrant. Men have bad taste, sorry. Men have bad taste and they get bored quickly.
May I interject with I'm in big trouble of my own?
Yes.
Right, because it is book related. It is book related. My husband is a vandal and a barbarian when it comes to books. Like, truly a caveman. Every time he reads one of my books, the spine gets cracked. He's putting it page side down on the bathroom floor so it gets all wet. He once dropped one of my books into the sea after I specifically asked him to look after it when he took it on holiday. And then I gave him a really big lecture about it. And he was like, can I borrow your copy of Evenings and Weekends? And I was like, yes, but you can't destroy it. I want it returned back to me in like a nice condition. And then he was sitting there reading it on the sofa one night. And then I saw he'd just written in the margins next to one of the bits, lol. So it wasn't even like an annotation, which was like really insightful or something. It was just him going, oh, I find this bit funny. So Moya, what do I do? How do I stop my husband, untrained golden retriever that he is, destroying all my books?
What's he said when you've talked to him about it?
He looks sheepish, but I can tell he's not that sorry.
I think if it really bothers you, you just need to say, hey, redacted name. I love you so much, but this does really bother me. And please don't do it to my books anymore. I'll buy you some of your own. You can do it to your own books, but I would love it if you don't. And usually that tone works. And I would say to this letter writer as well, you should try one more time and just say honestly to this guy, hey, this book actually means a lot to me and I don't want to make you feel even more guilty, but I would really like it back. And if we could just sort out a place for me to just get it quickly, that would be fantastic, even if you have to drop it to my friend. And if he doesn't do that, we personally will sort you out a new signed copy for machine. And that's my pledge.
We will do that. But I think this guy, I think he listens to the podcast. He's a bisexual man who's reading Evenings and Weekends. All right.
No, like, statistically. He's not reading it. She lent it to
him. He's possessing it.
He's just possessing it. This happens all the time. This is also why lending people books is a real letdown. I will say the guilt thing because I have a book in my possession that I also, books weirdly, a harbinger of when you're about to get dumped or end something. So someone lent me a book and I ended the situation, which sometimes I slightly regret because they were amazing and maybe I made a mistake, but let's not talk about that. I ended the situation and I still have the book and I think I offered to give it them back, but they said hang on to it for a while. And now I just have this book, which I would never open, even though it's a really amazing book, because I feel too guilty to open it about what happened. He's not opened that book. And I know other people, like I remember this guy who borrowed a book from me, not one that I'm that fussed about. He just was like, this looks interesting, can I borrow it? Next time I saw him, he dumped me. Like, the book is the heart, but the book, especially if you're someone who's slightly avoidant, it's getting too deep. They've lent me this book. Ah, panic, panic. He's not opened that book and that's his loss because it's a great book, but you should ask for it back.
I think that this guy's just like, he's sitting on it like he's trying to incubate an egg. He goes home and he just like sits on top of the book for a bit, brings it up to body heat, and then he thinks about how he's not giving it back to you. But if he is listening to this podcast, which statistically, I feel like he might be, just give the fucking book back. Otherwise, you're going to be roped into some kind of fake death stunt, all right? You don't need those kind of problems. Just
she's looking for closure.
Through the letterbox.
She's looking for closure that you're not going to get from this man because he's flaky and he pied you off, and we can never truly understand why someone rejects us. And sometimes even if they said to you, oh, it's because your hair was bad this one time, would that make you feel better? No. No, it's not going to. You have to just accept sometimes these things are not related to us and they're about the person. I've rejected so many amazing people. And you know what? It's because I'm a dumb, dumb avoidant. I'm a dumb, dumb who doesn't sort their shit out. And I don't want to be in a relationship down at my core. That's why. It's nothing to do with them.
Should we do another one?
Yeah, another one. You want another one?
Okay, let's go. I'm in big trouble. I've spent the last 8 years in social isolation and I now need to reverse it in just 1 month. Aside from my girlfriend and a twice yearly visit to my distant friend, I've not socialized since I left high school 8 years ago. I'm not sure why I didn't make friends at university. If it's relevant, I'm teetotal. However, getting fired / wanting to do a do-over of my 20s has made me enroll on a master's. Oh, by the way, congratulations. Let's just say that up top. Has made me enroll on a master's and I don't want to fuck up making friends again. However, my years of solitude mean I won't know how to be social or at least act normal. Do you have any tips for this green alien on trying to blend in? Or if the stars align, maybe even befriending the inhabitants of a human planet? P.S. No, it's not technically a dilemma, but others got away with it, so I thought it'd be cheeky. They gave a bit more detail about their situation. For uni, everyone seemed to form their groups in the first week and it seemed hard to break into these after that. For work, I've only worked fully remote since university and most people were only focused on the job. Even before these past 8 years, almost always people have made friends with me rather than the other way around, so I'm not really sure how the magic happens. My old course, computer science, my uni halls, my career were all very lad culture, think abrasiveness and sexist jokes, not simply beer and football, which is polar opposite to me. I'm not quiet, just a bit of a softy. I met my wonderful girlfriend at high school when we were both 16. We were both part of the same friendship group, all girls apart from me. The reason I decided to change was I, over time, realised connection and friendship was something I was missing so deeply that I'd put in any amount of work in, no matter how big, to at least try to reverse it. And I would have to proactively reverse the situation. I didn't mention it in my first email to keep it short and you didn't ask, but if it's relevant, my sole friend is diagnosed ASD and has said he thinks I'm also ASD, which I've heard some people say can be relevant to social skills. Anonymous.
I think it's so relevant that your friend thinks potentially you have ASD. That is going to change the way you interact with people and also how you form bonds. I've got friends and family who are definitely ASD. And lots of people think they're shy and they often, you know, can have interactions that some of us would think alike. And it's not that the world is not set up just to like take ASD people in and like be empathetic to them. A lot of the time, because it's their people like, oh, they're rude or they're this or that. It's things I've heard. And I'm like, actually, no, they just sometimes just don't get the same cues. This is not every ASD person. everyone has a different, you know, reaction. That's not the right word. Scrap that child before I get cancelled. This is not everyone with ASD. It's everyone, you know, it manifests differently. But just a lot of people around me, I've seen that pattern. How do you make friends? How do you be proactive? Especially if you potentially ASD. I would say, what are your interests? Same old advice. What are your interests? Join some clubs. Join some things where you literally share interests with people, because you'll find people on your same wavelength. All my friends have ADHD. Why? Because I joined an ADHD club. No, because birds of a feather flock together. And if you go to places where people have similar interests to you and you're there because you enjoy the same things, it's a quick fire shortcut to community. It's a shortcut to having something to talk about, especially if you're trying to warm up and remember, like, what are the rules, the general rules of socializing, the general rules of having contact with other people. And you don't have to necessarily follow them, especially if you're in spaces where other people, you know, might be of a similar mindset to you and might be people to just, they will get you as well. Like, I don't know, there's stuff that I'm really passionate about, like pop culture. And it's like, it's a secret language when someone understands what I'm saying, when I'm talking about the benefit of divorce and like getting into the weeds of it. And it's immediately, there's a community there. There's like a, you know, if there's a podcast you really enjoy, go to like the live recordings of that podcast and try and chat to people. Find these places where those shortcuts are already set up before you have to just sit in a pub and like try and entrance people by talking about yourself for an hour, is what I would say. That's a good way to ease you in.
I mean, the first thing is that you're starting a master's. There are a whole bunch of people who are being thrown together in a totally new context who will be wanting to make friends. So I understand that there's going to be this like huge sense of trepidation because you feel so out of the loop and you feel so out of practice and this feels very new for you. But you're entering into a situation where it's going to be very new for everyone else as well. Also, because it's a master's, it's not likely that everyone's going to be living in halls. So that sort of like real intense clubbiness from being an undergrad, I don't think that that's necessarily going to be the case for you starting a master's. I completely agree with Moya, which is join clubs which speak to like some of your interests, whatever they may be. And I think that like sometimes we have an idea that like that has to involve like being really sporty or already being really good at the thing. But like one of the things that like I want to do precisely because I'm not very good at the thing is join a chess club, because I really want to join a chess club. Because like one, I want to get better, and two, it's like, I want to find people who are also interested in this thing. You know, it's like a new way of branching out and finding community. I think that like there are just some like shortcuts. So like I sometimes feel really, really socially anxious. And one of the reasons why I feel socially anxious is because I feel I don't have room to be socially anxious and that everyone wants a really good experience from me. So I have perfected the art of what I call social jujitsu, which is like every question asked to me, I just turn it back around and ask it as a question to them. And as long as you do that with a decent amount of eye contact and just smile, people won't realize that like you're actually like fucking cacking it inside. You will create some instant connections and it's all going to be fine. So just remember, eye contact, smile, verbal jujitsu, reverse the question, join some clubs, you're going to be fine. And it's really, really good that you're starting a master's. Well done. Do you think we've got time for one tiny, teensy, weensy dilemma?
Yeah, which ones do we want to do? Do we want to do...
Let's do the last one.
Cool. My question is nothing new, but I'm starting to experience it for the first time. So now you have to hear about it too. Oh, I love it. I love when people say stuff like that. I say that all the time. How do you handle when your friends start to become richer than you? For context, I'm in my mid to late 20s working in the media industry, womp womp, with a correspondingly low salary and bad career prospects. I knew all this going in, and I chose this career because it corresponded with my politics, morals, and I thought it would be interesting. I have friends with similar politics who chose more boring but far more lucrative careers. Think consultants, accountants, so on. I felt smug in my early 20s when we were all on similar salaries, sharing the same shit mouldy flats and stealing pint glasses when my job was far more cool. But now they've shot ahead, and I can see our lifestyles beginning to diverge. They're going on nicer, more frequent holidays, buying better quality clothes, and have begun dropping hints they might gulp. Think about buying a house soon. Taking general wealth and class out of the picture, because we're all from similar middle-class backgrounds, how do you deal with the feeling of being left behind? When I start having to say no to joining them on their bougie travels, midweek dinners, and so on. I've since totally abandoned the neoliberal lie that you should love what you do. Should I just have been a fucking accountant? Or do I need to get new, poorer friends? You're very funny.
Yeah, really funny. I mean, look, I'm going to say it, and I'm not going to be as sort of padded with empathy as normal, just because we're a bit pushed for time. But what this is about is the like declining prospects for middle-class kids. Is what it's about. So it's like, I embarked on a middle-class career, but it has not delivered middle-class finances. Like, ah, what do I do? And this is a story which is being mimicked across the workforce and like across the world. I think that ultimately you have to both fight like hell against the conditions that you're in, but also accept that some things are a product of your choices. Like, you know, you chose to go into media. You probably didn't do that for money. And
they said they didn't.
Well, you said you didn't. But maybe you did. Maybe you did. Maybe deep down.
No, they said they knew all it going in, correspondingly low salary and bad career prospects.
Yeah. Knew all this going in. But you chose this career because it corresponded with your politics and your morals, and you thought it would be interesting. Well, there you go. There you go.
I think that actually points to something. The thing that we always are like, I knew all this going in, but I didn't think it would happen to me. That's basically what we always think. We're like, I knew all this going in, but I thought so it would change down the line. No. We make the mistake of always thinking we're the exception to the rule that we see happening to everyone else. And then we realise, oh, wait, I am actually, you know, subject to the same forces as everyone else. And it's a bit shit and I don't like it. Yeah, do you have any actual practical advice here?
Not really, because it's like, this is about how do you feel in relation to your friends that made different choices from you. It's not what should you do with your life, which would be a whole different thing. And we could talk about that, and we could talk about, you know, do you really want to sacrifice something which you derive identity from simply for something that you derive money from? Like, what are the kinds of pressures on you, et cetera, et cetera? Like, but really, this is about how do you relate to your friends who made different choices from you? Ultimately, you love them and you relate to them the same way you always have. And that might be difficult. You might have to work hard at it. You might feel envy and resentment at times. I think these are actually quite natural components of friendship as well. But you made some choices for what you wanted in your life. And that's okay.
Yeah, my practical advice is basically, you either need to find a media, you need to find a, sorry, this is going to be so cutthroat, I'm so sorry. Find a media job where you can also do freelancing that will get you a little bit extra money on the side. Or you need to find a media job where you have more satisfaction. I think if you had one of those two things, you would feel better. Because when you have real job satisfaction, then you kind of can put up with another shit. It's when you're feeling a bit like stagnant, or you're feeling like it's not delivering in the same way, or you don't love it as much. That's when everything else starts to bite, you know? Or you find somewhere where you have a side hustle, maybe not even in media. I do stuff on the side that's nothing to do with journalism, that just has a little bit extra pocket money. That helps. That helps with when I want to go on my big trips. But also talk to your friends. Be honest about how you're feeling. And say, maybe we could go do a bougie holiday, but in somewhere like, I don't know, Bosnia, because the cost is much lower. Sorry if anyone's offended by me being really cutthroat about that and being like, go somewhere cheaper, but that's still as cool and bougie, because it's so like classic, like Western tourists loves to go and travel in Central Europe where it's much cheaper. But you don't have to go to the fucking Maldives, and your friends can do that a later date if they want, but just say, can we go on a group haul? I've got friends who say that. Can we go on a group haul to this place because it is cheaper and I can afford it and we can all meet in the middle?
You know what? That sounds like very wise advice. The wisest advice is, I think we should wrap up here.
Yes, Ash, as always, you are the wisest Al among us. I've been Moira Lady McLean. You've been...
Ash Sarka, the wisest amongst you. That will now be my sign-off forevermore. This has been If I Speak.
Bye!
Goodbye!